What if we could reimagine the traditional notion of a high flyer? Hey friends, welcome back. Welcome to the High Flyers podcast, where we do reimagine a high flyer, showcase relatable role models and their journey in work and life, including their sunrise, magic moments, hustle, and much, much more to help you achieve your potential, become your best self, and continue to be 1% better every single day. I'm your host, Vidit Agarwal, and let's get started. Welcome to installment 19 in the Special Curiosity series on the show. Today, I'm joined by Sylvia Pfeiffer, the co-founder and CEO of CoView, the all-in-one virtual care engagement platform for better healthcare. Learn about Sylvia's fascinating journey to date, from Germany to moving to Australia at the turn of the century, starting a PhD in computer science, and how she was involved in bringing video technology to the web, first through her own startup, VQuence, and then working on video caption functionality for YouTube. All these rich experiences and learnings led Sylvia to create CoView, the successful healthcare business she now leads with over 50 team members in Australia and the US. I asked Sylvia about the problem they're solving, their business model, overcoming physical examination barriers, successful virtual care platforms, and more. It's now time to explore your curiosity. Please enjoy. Sylvia Pfeiffer, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
I'm excited to have you on. Let's start with some fun facts. Where were you born and where do you live now?
I was born in Germany, in actually a little country town that nobody knows about, between Stuttgart and Nuremberg on the so-called Romantic Road. So really quaint town. My hometown has a river and a castle. And so it's just really, it was created in like the year 1000, and it still only has about 4,000 inhabitants. So, you know, it's a tiny little town, hasn't had much growth.
And you moved to Australia in the year 2000, is that right?
Just before, actually. We came in 1999 because we wanted to be in Australia for the turn of the century, be one of the first people to welcome the new century and to experience the fireworks in Sydney and all that kind of stuff. We came here with all these grand ideas about how amazing Australia is. And we actually wanted to come just for 1 year. And that I'm still here tells you how much I've embraced the country and really love it.
It always starts like that, right? I've had so many guests on the show. They all say they come for a year on a tourist visa and then end up meeting their partner, or they just fall in love with the city and they stay for, what is it now, 22, 23 years for you. So very cool. And what was your first job and what do you do now?
Oh, yeah, first job, that's a long time ago. I probably the first job I had was an internship in a hospital, actually. So I was working there helping the nurses with the cleaning and on station to help with the patients. It was actually a Catholic hospital, which came with its own restrictions. I couldn't have a boy in town who was a friend of mine, and I couldn't have him come in for visits. We had to meet outside the hospital. Wow. And funny things like that back in the day. I actually want to point out another job that I also had, and I don't know which one was actually my first one. I was helping with kids in a home for mothers of disabled children. So that's a holiday home that they went to just for a couple of weeks to recuperate from their work with the disabled children. And as a local, so that was in my hometown, that home where they would take holidays. And as a local, I came in during school holidays and helped out and earned a little bit of money helping with the kids. That gave me a huge love for, for helping people that weren't born the same way with the same privileges that I was born.
And these were all roles in Germany?
Yes, that was all in Germany. Hmm. I only came to Australia when I was, well in my 30s, so it was a long time ago.
and I want to get to that in a second. It'll be cool to talk about what you were doing early on in Australia, because you worked on a few interesting projects. But how would you describe your role now?
My role now is as a CEO of CoView. So CareView is a health technology company with telehealth and virtual care. And we've grown this business from spinning it out of the CSIRO to now be 51 staff. So it's a pretty massive journey we're on and a really interesting experience. So that's my current role.
That's a big team, 51 people. That is not a small team by any means. So well done on that growth. And I want to talk about that growth in a couple of minutes. But yeah, you mentioned about moving to Australia in 2000. I'd be curious because, as you said, you didn't come as a student. You came with that work experience. But every time, even now when you hear people talk about Australia, you don't hear about innovation and technology the same way some of the, particularly the US, probably even Europe to an extent. So tell us about what you were doing in those early days, because I know you worked with CSIRO. I don't know if that was in 2000, if that was later on, but what were kind of your projects and work in the early part of the decade?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I came to Australia after completing my PhD in computer science in Germany. In 1999, it was actually computer science and business management is what I studied. And then I did my PhD in computer science and I was looking around what to do after that. I was looking for a postdoc position. And I looked in different countries because I just wanted to get a little bit of experience in another country. America looked interesting. I could have started with IBM. I had an offer. Canada looked interesting. Canada as a country always fascinated me, but it's a bit cold. And then there were these offers from CSIRO in Australia. So later, who became a colleague of mine, reached out to me and said, why don't you come and do a postdoc with us here in Australia? You can just come for a year. I've seen your publications in international journals, and I'd like you to work with our team on automated captioning. So that's an area that I was very passionate about as well. It was very much in the region of what I did my PhD in, which is on audio analysis. And I was fascinated by it and packed up my husband and my son and we transferred to Australia and he got a job here as well. He was working at Accenture at the time and Accenture said, oh, okay, we'll transfer you to Australia. We'll pay for your, for removals, etc. And we came here and we were actually just wanting to come for a year, but we fell in love with Australia and I'm still here.
You mentioned audio analysis. That's really interesting because I have a personal interest given podcasting is all about audio and there's a lot of analysis involved. But I'd love to understand the PhD in computer science because that's not one I've heard very often. Like you hear computer science and you hear PhD, but two separate worlds. What does it mean to do a PhD in computer science? Because that's clearly very specialized, but also you're very smart. The fact that you're doing a PhD in computer science, so that should be acknowledged. But can you share some of the work that is involved in a PhD in computer science, and what kind of career paths does that generally open up?
It's a career path that's become more and more common. We still work yet now in my current company. We work with the CSIRO and several universities, and there's often a PhD student involved that would do a PhD in computer science of some sort. That could be, most of the time it's computer vision, right? What they would do is they would analyze a video and segment that into its different components and identify certain things. We're currently involved in a program called WoundView, where we're analyzing wounds via video and segmenting out the depth of the wound, the pussiness and things like that, you know, just to help with the diagnostics really around the wounds. And so you can imagine somebody would actually go on their career path for that, doing a degree in computer science or maybe even computer engineering and then maybe a master's. And after that, they decide they'd want to specialize even further and they do a PhD. In Germany, that's a 5-year effort. Here, I think it's more like 2 or 3 years, and you write a PhD thesis afterwards. So my book my PhD thesis was published and was like 250 pages, so a whole book. Here, I think they're typically a little bit smaller. My whole career, my education was all in Germany, so I'm not fully across everything here in Australia. But certainly there's a number of people that go through those pathways. And oftentimes when they've done their PhD, they go on to a more academic career. They often work as, you know, assistant professors or something like that at universities or lecturers. And some of them might join the CSIRO for research, but oftentimes it opens up a career in research.
That's incredible. And you're spot on that often you hear researchers, they become university lecturers or they're involved in the kind of idea side, not the execution side. So kudos to you for going, no, I don't want to just write papers, but I want to actually build a business and do talk to customers and do all the hard kind of roll your sleeves up sort of work. And your point about Germany is really interesting. There's this documentary on Netflix called The Billion Dollar Code. I'm not sure if you've seen that. It's about these two German software developers who apparently built the first Google Maps. And the documentary is about how they take Google to court and they sort of say that Google stole the idea. They unfortunately lose the case, but it goes into kind of Berlin in the 90s and German culture and really interesting. So while you were saying that, that's what I was visualizing. I wonder if Berlin was like that in the 90s. I know Berlin now is quite a big tech hub, but back then they even talk about how they sneaked into computer labs when it was locked and the security guard would run after them. And I'm not sure if you have any of those kind of experiences, but you should definitely check out that documentary if you haven't already.
Yeah, I'll watch it. Certainly when I was at university, there was it was the beginnings of all computer science. It was really a time where computer science was still relatively young. The internet had been invented, but the World Wide Web hadn't. We only started with the World Wide Web, I think, in 1992. So, you know, the World Wide Web, as we know it, what everyone now calls the internet, when they put a URL in a web browser, that stuff is actually fairly new. And we got involved with the beginnings of that. And as you say, you know, students at university were all involved in those kinds of things. In Germany, the big computer science universities are Berlin and probably Karlsruhe. I was at Mannheim, which had more of a tendency towards business. So you would get business degrees in Mannheim. And the computer science degrees in Mannheim were always tacked on a business degree. So I had a double degree in business management and computer science, because I always had this idea that whatever technology I would be involved in developing, I would take into industry. So, you know, I came here to actually do that with the CSIRO and to make that work, which was actually quite hard in the time that I came in, like 1999-2000, around that time. CSIRO was very much focused on fundamental research and not so much set up for commercializing. They would commercialize things by having contracts with large organizations, Boeing or somebody like that, and they would develop technology and then commercialize it through that international organization. That obviously didn't bring much wealth to Australia. It brought more revenue to CSIRO. All of that changed massively in the last couple of years, and particularly the ON Accelerate program that the CSIRO created changed that, and Main Sequence Ventures as well. So, you know, that whole pathway towards more commercialization out of research, we're really truly on that pathway now. It's really fascinating to see.
Yeah, and Main Sequence are doing some really cool stuff. I had Bill Barty on my show about 20 or so episodes ago, and he's been involved in technology similar to you from the very early days, from the early 2000s, and very one of the kind of godfathers of venture, which he hates me saying that, but he definitely is.
He definitely is has been around for a very long time, and I've always looked up to him. He's probably the reason why we got spun out of CSIRO and got investment. So, you know, I have the highest respect for Bill and for what Main Sequence are trying to do.
And I think your point earlier was really interesting, is that you went into CSIRO and sort of technology broadly at a time where there's a lot of change, was now the path maybe is clearer for kind of potential founders. So I imagine you probably had a lot of ideas and CoView was one of them. Can you share that? Like, what were the other ideas you were exploring? Because again, you were this researcher, so you'd probably be aware of a lot of the research available, you would be speaking to a lot of people, and you'd probably have that kind of risk aversion, right? Because we always hear they say founders need to be a bit delusional, but when you're such a researcher, you probably get into the detail and you're like, you know what, this, I don't like it. I've done all the research. So how did you settle on CoView, and what were some of the other ideas you were exploring?
It's a long time between when I joined CSIRO in around 2000 to when I actually started getting involved with CoView and started CoView, which was more around 2012. So a whole decade between that. And in that decade, I actually, in 2006, I created my first startup in the CSIRO, out of the CSIRO, because I had worked on bringing video to the web. Let's just be very clear. In the year 2000, there were no videos on the web, and the only videos that we had was eventually Adobe. What was it called? Adobe's videos. So they're tiny little, you know, stamp-sized videos that we had on the web, and everybody thought it was never going to get better. And I said, that's just the beginning of the technology. It's going to get better and better, and digital video is going to be the future. And so I created a project called the Continuous Media Web, where I was talking about how continuous media, which is, you know, video and audio, will become part of the future of the web. So I made some specifications around how that would work. I wrote some technology around how we could do seeking into time offsets in videos and audio files and all that kind of stuff. So I was imagining what a future of webs of videos would like, you know, linking from video to video and stuff like that. And so, as you said, there's a whole lot of risk involved in creating a company. So I wasn't quite ready at the time. So I did my research within CSIRO more around standards. And I was involved with the World Wide Web Consortium, which is the standards body for the internet or for the World Wide Web, where specifications are written, becoming part of the beginnings of a next type of World Wide Web, which would have video at its center. I could completely foresee that. And so in 2006, I decided it was time for me to spin this whole technology out of CSIRO. This was my first spin out. And the company was called Vequence. Here I was alone in Australia trying to build a company around video search technology on the web without any funding, right? I had no funding. I was trying to raise capital. CSIRO had given me a 3 months leave where I leave without pay, where I could come back afterwards. So go and risk it a little bit and try and see if I could put something together. I was trying to raise capital and find a co-founder and all those kinds of things. We got pretty close. We actually got a little bit of funding out of Victoria. I can't even remember which fund that was, but it was a Victorian government fund, which was very nice. And so we had a couple of people starting to build technology with me. We built a video search engine and video search website. Vequence stands for video sequences. So we would search videos and we would compose the videos together in little sequences of videos to present the search results, the video search results in a visual order as a little video. And you could then click back through to the original videos, which is still something that nobody does. And I'm not sure still whether that is, you know, the best way to do video search, but it was an interesting idea.
So it sounds like you had the early YouTube idea.
This was just before YouTube got started. And so we had started this, and a year on in that whole process, YouTube got started. And Google, another couple months on, Google decided to create their own video search engine. And here I was in Australia with very little funding at a time where Australians were only just exploring venture capital. Bill Butty was around. I actually pitched the idea to him. He wasn't quite interested at the time. And I don't blame him because, you know, a little startup in Australia at that point in time could not compete with a Google or a YouTube. It just was not possible. I was trying to do a B2C company, funded through advertising, doing search, and it just wouldn't go anywhere, right? So we pivoted. We created the opposite. We started crawling the internet. We started crawling YouTube and Vimeo and all these websites that were publishing video to build a base of knowledge around that content where advertisers could look for the brands that they were representing. And that was something that kind of worked. We got some customers and we built that out. And that company we actually only closed down in 2012. It didn't make much money, though. It wasn't a unicorn. But I learned a lot. I made all the mistakes in the book, right? I had to, I created a business without having enough funding, a B2C business that nobody was interested in, was technology focused, didn't really have a good business model, didn't know who my customers were, all of those kinds of things, made all the mistakes in the book, and I learned so much from it so that when the second time came around, a couple of years later for CoView, I knew all the things I had to do. And I made different mistakes, but you make mistakes as you go.
Yeah, I was going to say exactly that. And it probably helped with your transition from that researcher to execution and operations, which I imagine was really helpful in your second idea. And tell us about that. So in 2012, what was kind of the problem you felt CoView could solve?
So after I finished we had started Vequence and I wasn't making enough money, I actually got a job offer from Mozilla. So I was working at Mozilla on captioning. Mm. And then I got a job offer from Google and I was working with Google on captioning. And I actually implemented the video. I was part of the video team in YouTube that created the captioning functionality for YouTube. And also I was working on the Google Chrome browser on the video controls that are automatically displayed. So some of my software is in YouTube and in Google Chrome, which I'm still quite happy about. So I worked there. My former boss at the CSIRO came back to me. By that time, he was working at Nikta, and he said he wants to create something new around this new technology, which is called WebRTC, which brings video streaming, live video, to the web. And I was involved in the standards body for that. I was involved in writing some of the standards. I had created one of the first actual demonstrators, and I'd been teaching about it at conferences while working at Google. And so he picked up on that, and he said, "You have to join Nikta. You have to come and join us and build new technology for healthcare and for government services." He had those two really big ideas in mind, where video would really help bring better access to rural and remote areas, both with government services and with healthcare. And so in 2012, I joined Nikta at the time, which later became part of CSIRO. So, I came full circle back into CSIRO. And we created some initial demonstrators. We worked with Royal Far West School out in Manly, who were delivering speech pathology sessions into rural and remote Australia, into Far West New South Wales. And they told us how horrible the existing video conferencing technologies for their purposes. They could not play their games with the kids. They could not use any of the stimulus material that they use to educate children with speech pathology. And so I said, "Well, I've got this new technology, WebRTC. Shall we try and build something that's more appropriate for you?" And they were very keen. And so within a couple of weeks, we put an MVP together, a minimum viable product, actually more a demonstrator, because it wasn't really making any money at that time. And we put this together and they got so attached to it, they just would not let go of it again. It took me 2 years to shut down that website again because they loved it so much. So I knew I had something. I knew there was an interest by healthcare professionals about doing something better for telehealth and for delivering healthcare remotely. And so that's what we dug into.
So you had this problem that you felt you could solve. And I've had a number of healthcare founders on the podcast, whether it be Vexev or Nutromics or Heidi Health. And one of the things they've all said is selling to healthcare providers or hospitals or GPs is next to impossible. It's a long sales cycle, long feedback loops, very conservative, very traditional industries. How did you decide? Okay, so if you had that demonstration, that MVP, what about the go-to-market? How did you approach that early on? And maybe also who was like your first customer?
Yeah, very good question. telehealth at the time was something that had been tried before for many years, of course. There were companies in the space, Cisco and even Microsoft with Teams or the precursor of Teams. They were in this space. Adobe had a video platform that were sort of monopolizing the space and were making money from it, but mostly through hospitals. They were targeting hospitals, and they were targeting the connection of hospitals to each other. That's the kind of telehealth that was around before. And the direct to a private practitioner who has their own practice, telehealth kind of thing, that wasn't something that was very common. However, the government had tried this a little bit before. So the government had put Medicare reimbursements in place around, I don't remember exactly anymore, let's say around 2010, where they wanted to encourage GPs to pick up telehealth and to offer telehealth to patients. And that didn't quite pick up because they encouraged them to buy a computer with a webcam and they gave them money for it. And then they required them to do one telehealth consult at minimum. And of course, everyone spent the money on upgrading their computers and then did one telehealth consult and then moved on, right? Mm. So it wasn't a transformation of the industry. It was a pilot, so to speak. But then the one thing that changed in the industry and that Medicare did over the next years after that was they wanted to deliver mental health consultations into rural and remote areas. And there's a plan that they called Better Access. Better Access was the Medicare, the name for the Medicare plan that allowed psychologists and psychiatrists to offer mental health services into rural and remote areas. And that one finally got a bit of traction. And so while we started with speech pathologists and we went to all the speech pathology conferences, etc., we realized very quickly that the psychologists were the key target area where we would make a difference, because not a lot of people would actually sell to these healthcare providers a technology that they could use to get these reimbursements via Better Access. And they were using Skype and FaceTime for their calls with the patients, which are not clinical, which were not really secure at the time. You were not encouraged to actually do clinical transactions over it. They couldn't take payments. They couldn't do Medicare reimbursements. All those kinds of things would stop them from using that and doing it better. So we introduced that technology, and that's where we saw our first traction in psychology mostly. And it was a hard slog. You're completely right. It is really hard to sell to healthcare providers because they just don't want any new technology. They just want to continue doing the services that they do. It really took up until the pandemic to make the behavioral change that was necessary. Before then, it was more like the occasional practitioner got really excited about it. They had patients that they knew they could not reach in any other way, and that's why they did it. Since the pandemic, it's been a very different story.
And then, like you said, those early customers in speech pathology, and yes, COVID was probably that wind that you need on your back, but you've still got to build a business. You've still got to generate revenue. You've got to hire a team. How did you look at the business model in the early days, and has that business model evolved now as we're coming out of COVID?
Yes, absolutely. Most telehealth companies that were targeting primary care practitioners at the time that we started around 2018 would provide a service. They would provide the clinicians and the technology and sell directly to patients. And so patients would go on a website. They would find where they can get a sick note or where they could get a prescription, that kind of stuff. And that's the kind of telehealth companies that existed when we spun out. We were different. We wanted to focus on technology and just really provide the healthcare businesses with a technology platform. You can imagine, I don't have a healthcare background. I don't know how to manage healthcare providers. I don't know what's a good healthcare service. I would feel really horrible having to tell clinicians how to better service patients because I don't have any knowledge in that space. So I always, as a business, we always focus just on building the best possible technology and listening to our customers, listening to the healthcare providers, what they needed to be able to provide a better service. And so that's what we did. We offered a technology, and right from the start, because I had so much background with the web, it was quite clear to me that it had to be a software as a service platform with self sign up online. Clinicians would just go on the website, click a couple of buttons, and could immediately start using it. That was my goal. That's what we set up. And that's what saved us in 2020 when the pandemic came, because the self service allowed us to achieve the scale. Most other companies that had done anything with telehealth, you would need to call up as a business. You would need to talk to a salesperson at the company. You would need to get specific credentials set up, etc. All of that was manual, and that doesn't scale, right? That's all manual process. And when something like the pandemic hits and everybody wants your software immediately, then the right thing to do is set up self-service, and that's what we already had in place, which really helped us to scale.
And so does that mean if I'm a speech pathologist, I sign up to a subscription on Covi, so yes. I pay a monthly fee to use your platform?
Yes, either monthly or annual.
Yeah, cool. And then I also understand, I was talking to my partner who works in the medical field, and I said, do you have any questions you want to ask Sylvia? And one of the things she was sort of curious about is she said, how do you overcome the language and the physical examination barriers? Because she felt that's the challenge with virtual. You can't do that. And she's a pediatrician, so you have to touch the patient and feel them. And even the translation, she said, particularly with immigrants and people that perhaps don't have English as their first language. Is that something that was a concern for you, or is that something you didn't have to worry about, particularly with speech pathology, where even if people have English as the first language, they clearly need help with speech. That's why they're going to a speech pathologist. But then you add on someone who's got cultural differences, maybe from Germany or from India. How does virtual, this is more broad, not just COVID, but the virtual side, how does virtual tackle that? Or is that a problem?
Absolutely, yes. What we've done is we've partnered with a couple of companies that provide interpreters for in healthcare. And so typically when you do that, when you're at a hospital or something, and you know that somebody's coming in who doesn't speak the language, you have to book these people days in advance. They would come in and they would sit in and do the translation live, or you would get them on the phone and they would translate live. What we did, we were actually partnering with a couple of those interpreter companies, and we would allow the clinicians with a sidebar to just say, okay, I've got a person with that language, I need an interpreter, send off the request. And within 2 minutes, then these companies bring in their interpreters into the live video call. And so you can actually have the coverage of language translation with experienced medical translators right in your video call. So we developed this in the last couple of years through our marketplace. So we built a marketplace. We thought that was really the key, that after we had talked to a lot of clinicians, we found out that they found it limited to just have what I call talking heads. You know, they talk to a person, and that's not how healthcare is delivered. As you said before, you know, there's often touch involved. There might be measurements involved, a pulse oximeter that you need to stick on your finger to get the pulse and your oxygenation of blood. So devices might be involved, and tests, standardized assessments to see an intelligence test or a depression test or things like that. You know, there's other materials involved always in healthcare that clinicians use to find out more about what's wrong with you. It's not just, you know, eyeing you. We obviously cannot replace touch. That is not possible. If somebody needs to be physically examined, you either need to have somebody present at the other end who can be your hands, who you can guide and who can tell you what's happening, or you need to have an in-person consultation. That is quite clearly not possible. But every time you ask a clinician to think about how many of their sessions that they had in the day actually require touch, when you make them think about it, they come back with a statement, well, you're quite right, not all of my sessions require touch. A lot of them are check-ins, and I just talk with them about how they're going. I take notes about how they've improved, etc. So those check-in sessions make up a majority of the calls. So even with GPs, we found that 40 to 60% of consultations can be done via video without making a difference in the quality of healthcare that gets provided. other professions, mental health, it's almost 100% that can be done via video. You know, there is not much touching happening in mental health. And then you've got professions, you know, like surgeries, 0%. You know, it really depends on your medical profession, how much telehealth you can provide. But almost all professions have some capability of transforming their sessions into a video telehealth or a phone telehealth consultation.
Yeah, I feel for your sales team. I'm sure they're having a lot of these conversations where they go and try and get some new customer on board. And that's where the first question is, am I going to lose my job if I go on to, on to CoView? I want to, Sylvia, you mentioned about venture funding in 2006 and how it was quite nascent. And then 2018, I think it was a lot more mature.
Yes.
Bill Bharti had started Blackbird with Nikki and Rick, and there was a bunch of other VCs. And you've obviously raised for some really well-known VCs in EVP, in Giant Leap, in Main Sequence, and a few angels. Tell us about that experience. Like, what was the kind of, how did you decide that, okay, I need to go externally and raise funding? Because as you know, when you should raise funding, there's a lot more different expectations, and they expect you to be a $1 billion business. And some founders don't want to do that. Some founders want to build a $1 million business and bootstrap it. How did you decide you wanted VC funding? And did you have any kind of particular things you felt they could help you with that you couldn't do yourself?
Well, when we spun CoView out of the CSIRO in about 2018, I had had many years of thinking about this. As you know, we stayed in CSIRO for 6 years, and I had thought long and hard about whether I could bootstrap this. And I did not think it was possible. I thought it needed a massive change in the industry and a transformation of the industry. Plus, it needed a lot of technology. As you're saying, you know, eventually there'll be some tasks that doctors are doing that that will be replaced by machines. And we can do that quite easily when we are in a digital environment like this, you know. And so when we have these tasks that might be replaced by computers, those tasks need to be done really, really well by a computer. So you need to develop the technology. You need to make sure it works 100% or a very, very high rate. And then you need to go and take it through TGA approval, because Therapeutic Goods Administration in Australia won't let you just use any kind of technology on patients. There are regulations around what you can do and what you're allowed to do. So it's deep tech that you're creating. It's artificial intelligence technology. It's machine learning technology. And it's software as a medical device technology that gets created that needs to go through regulatory approval. That's a lot of money that has to be, you know, invested before you actually get to a product that you can make money from. So all of this requires investment, and you can't bootstrap that. So while we were doing a telehealth technology and we had built like the foundations at CSIRO, we knew that this wasn't going to be enough. We knew that we needed more. We knew we needed digital therapeutics, diagnostic technology, therapeutic technology in a video call, and that needed a deep technology investment. And that's where Bill Bharti and Main Sequence came in. And they realized that that's what we were doing. They saw us build a range of motion calculator around joints to replace, you know, an ordinary goniometer, which is what a physiotherapist uses these days, such a protractor that kind of calculates the angle around a joint. And so we are replacing that with a video analysis based algorithm. And to do this kind of stuff, you need deep pockets, you need investment. And that's why we went out to venture capital. We got our first investment round from Main Sequence in 2018, and then another big investment round in 2020 after we had the growth through the pandemic and we could demonstrate the interest in the industry. And since then, we've just been growing. You know, we've been growing usage, we've been growing, broadening out our base, and we've grown also from doing video telehealth alone to also doing phone telehealth and to offer group therapy. And we're now building out something that is a whole virtual care engagement platform, so clinicians can engage virtually with their patients in all sorts of modalities. That's where we're going, really giving solutions to clinicians that are all encompassing And that gives them a a peace of mind around the patient data, that the patient data is being handled in a secure way, and that their processes are really supported.
And that's probably going to be my last question to close out the conversation, is that today, and also you've recently expanded to the US, which is a big deal, so congratulations on that. And your point about the kind of transition from just being telehealth to a virtual care platform, can you demystify that for some of our listeners and even me? I don't quite understand what that means. I understand that in theory, but in practice, that sounds like a lot of work. It sounds like a lot of things, and you're kind of trying to be a kind of approach for everyone. But can you maybe just in simple terms unpack what do you mean by virtual care platform?
Yeah, very good question. So what we call telehealth right now, and I think a lot of people have picked up on what telehealth is through the pandemic, because they had to stay home and they had to see their doctors either via phone call or via video call. That's what telehealth is. And that's just the beginning of what virtual care is. Virtual care means using technology to get better care. And that could be a live interaction between you and your clinician, obviously via phone and video, but also via text. You might want to talk to your clinician via text chat. You might have a text consultation, or you might want to check in with them frequently because, you know, something that is bothering you, you want to get a quick answer, but you don't want to go to a full a clinical visit. So those are some of the interactive mechanisms where you use technology to interact with your clinician. But for a full virtual care platform, there are other things also. Remote patient monitoring specifically is one of those things where you use your mobile phone to capture your health data. You can either capture it by entering your health data via forms yourself, you know, answering questions every day you're being asked. How are you feeling today? Are you still feeling depressed? What is your mood? You know, all those kinds of things that might help with a mental health check-in. Or if you have, let's say you have COVID and you have a pulse oximeter, then every morning, midday and evening, you might be asked to put that device on your finger and to capture the data, put it in an app or connect it via Bluetooth, and the app already gets the data. And that data is sent off to your clinician. And your clinician has a dashboard where they can see what all of their patients are doing. And get some red flags on patients that they really need to check in. So if somebody is having a depressive episode, doctor knows that this is happening. It's not something that you have to reach out to a doctor, but finally the doctor actually can remotely monitor you and can actually check in with you if they see that you're not in a good place, and can help you. So that's where virtual care is going in the future. We're going to be seeing a lot more of this happening across a lot more of the chronic illnesses that we are having increasingly more of in Australia. And so we want to build the technology platform for this to be able to be possible, to have the best possible interaction between a patient and a clinician.
It almost sounds like you mentioned Teams earlier. You're trying to build a Microsoft suite for healthcare, like have all the products within the CoView banner and provide different use cases.
A bit like that, but really just focused around healthcare and the interaction between patient and clinician. Yes.
I think my personal learning has been, I always had a perception that to work for a health tech, you had to come from a healthcare background. But as I've spoken to you and many other founders, I've learned you actually don't. It's actually better not to, because then you bring that fresh perspective. And like we said at the start of the call, healthcare people have all this baggage and they go, this can't work. Or someone comes in from a tech background, they go, let's just try it and see what happens. So absolutely.
Yeah. Well, we can't do it without the clinicians. We can't do it without input from healthcare professionals. And we have a number of healthcare professionals in the company, but they're certainly not a majority. The majority of our staff don't have a healthcare background. Mm. We're a technology company. After all, it's health tech. It's technology. And we're trying to help convert the industry to better use technology to become more efficient and effective in the future, because there just aren't enough clinicians around for the needs that we have for the future. Mm. And so we want to support those that are there in doing their work better, in not getting stressed out, in being able to manage with a larger workload with less effort. And so that's what we're trying to do with virtual care.
Sylvia, I'd love to keep talking, but that's the finish line. Thank you so much for joining me. Love what you're doing and wish you all the best.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
I hope you've taken away some valuable insights from this conversation to apply to your lives and continue to be 1% better every day. And stay tuned for the next episode in this Curiosity series, where we take you inside another topic, company, or industry.